This is a Power Broadcast program. More information at powerbroadcast.com.
Few works of American fiction, I think, ignite such immediate, polarized reactions as J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye. It's, you know, it's a ubiquitous high school assignment, a cultural touchstone, and, well, a lightning rod for censorship. It functions as a powerful coming-of-age story, a blistering satire, and certainly a critical look at post-war American conformity.
And that immediate polarization is really key to understanding its lasting power, isn't it? I mean, it's a book that readers either deeply connect with, seeing a reflection of their own alienated youth, or they find Holden just utterly insufferable. That intense tension, I believe, is completely by design.
And that enduring tension really defines our central question for today. We're debating whether Holden Caulfield's signature style, his pervasive, judgmental tone, his obsessive repetition of slang, and his profound self-imposed alienation actually represents a fundamental structural or literary flaw that, you know, limits the novel's universal relevance and critical longevity.
Whereas I maintain that his signature flaws are not weaknesses to be overcome, but are in fact the essential, intentional rhetorical strategy Salinger uses to deliver a profound social protest. We can frame his relentless negativity as a 20th century jeremiad, a structural necessity that validates and really drives the book's critique.
Right. And I'll be arguing that while the critique is certainly present, the subjective and deeply flawed nature of the protagonist ultimately impedes the novel's lasting effectiveness, causing a form of critical weariness that dulls its impact today.
Then let's delve into that weariness and what you think generates it.
Okay. Well, the issue really begins with Holden's voice itself. To many contemporary readers, he comes across as abrasive, and he just lacks the self-awareness required of an effective social critic. He is often perceived as shrill, obnoxious, judgmental, and whiny. His constant, almost pathological rants against phony adults have become so common in literary imitation that they now feel cliché, especially considering the narrow socioeconomic bracket he represents.
But isn't that reading the text a little bit outside of his historical moment? When Salinger wrote this, that voice was revolutionary. It was a completely unfiltered first-person perspective on teenage disillusionment that had really no precedent in mainstream literature.
It may have been revolutionary, sure, but its execution was repetitive. Even by 1950s standards, critics noted early on the tedious repetition of specific slang, particularly the word phony. This linguistic monotony speaks to a lack of narrative originality. More significantly, the novel increasingly feels relevant only to a distinctly narrow demographic, the spoiled, private school-educated male child of privilege. If your experience doesn't align with that very specific niche, the novel risks being dismissed as just a shocking book that no longer shocks. Its concerns too dated to sustain universal resonance.
I find that perspective a little too dismissive of the novel's core intellectual architecture. I come at it from a different way. Holden's highly critical and, yes, judgmental voice is intentionally structured as a spiritual protest, which places Salinger squarely within the tradition of the American Jeremiad. This tradition aims to call out societal flaws and urge the nation toward moral self-correction. Holden is the reluctant prophet, and the very intensity of his language is essential to that genre.
But if the prophet is manifestly unreliable and unstable, how is the sermon anything more than the ravings of a troubled teenager? A Jeremiah requires some moral authority, not just petulance.
His youth validates the message because he's pointing out the corrosion that adults have just come to accept as normal. His indictments are highly specific and highly purposeful, targeting the exact moral vacuum Salinger observed in post-war America. He critiques the superficial commercialization of spiritual life. You know, think of his disgust at the Christmas show at Radio City Music Hall. He attacks religious hypocrisy embodied by the wealthy, morally suspect Ossenberger, and the general replacement of genuine spiritual morality with conformity and relentless materialism. This intensity was necessary to pierce the veneer of a 1950s society that was just defined by conformity and consumed with image.
Okay, and what's your evidence that this critique actually landed effectively against the status quo?
The reaction to the novel itself, its notorious history of intense controversy, banning, and official censorship, being labeled downright un-American for criticizing institutions like the teaching profession and traditional home life, that serves as absolute proof of its efficacy. The critics and the censors, by embodying the very institutional phoniness that Holden rails against, they inadvertently validated that Salinger's protests successfully struck at the heart of the dominant culture. The discomfort the book caused confirms its power as a successful irritant to the established order.
That's a compelling reading of the novel as a cultural irritant, I'll grant you that. But where does the text itself falter in sustaining that moral authority? I see why you emphasize the protest, but let me give you a different perspective that focuses on Holden's profound lack of credibility. When we analyze him as an unreliable narrator, his critique becomes, well, fatally undermined.
In what way?
He constantly self-sabotages. And, crucially, he engages in the very phony behaviors he condemns in others. We see him lying compulsively, you know, using Rudolf Schmidt's name, or spinning these ridiculous, elaborate tales to Ernest Morrow's mother on the train. He is constantly performing. And this massive internal contradiction prevents him from serving as any kind of effective moral center. He rails against performance and superficiality while actively creating it for his own self-serving reasons. This profound self-centeredness and his inability to examine his own behavior, it leads scholars to diagnose a form of mental instability, often leaning toward narcissism, which fractures any claim he has to moral superiority.
A weakness in the narrative. It is a profound literary effect designed to expose his deep psychological vulnerability. We are not meant to see him as a reliable prophet, but as a traumatized victim. He uses alienation and the associated impulsive lying and distancing behaviors as a protective layer, a psychological defense mechanism meant to shield him from anticipated mockery and rejection, which, you know, he fears above all else.
So you're suggesting his hypocrisy is simply a symptom of his condition?
Precisely. His inability to consciously indict himself or fully realize his own flaws is symptomatic of the psychological breakdown he is undergoing. This structure illustrates the profound emotional cost of navigating and being rejected by the adult world. His contradictory behavior is the symptom of the trauma inflicted by phony expectations, not the cause of the novel's limitation. The reader is meant to pity the vulnerable adolescent, not just judge the hypocrite.
If we accept that lens, okay, we still have to contend with the novel's structural failure regarding narrative expectations. Salinger presents the text, at least initially, as a Bildungsroman. Could you maybe clarify for our listeners what that entails?
Sure.
A Bildungsroman is, broadly speaking, a novel focused on the protagonist's psychological and moral growth from youth into adulthood. It's a narrative of education and formation, culminating in the protagonist's successful integration into society.
Exactly. And the novel structurally fails that expectation by concluding with Holden in a psychiatric facility, unresolved and frankly unstable. His terror over growing up is often described by critics as childish, and his psychic instability is seemingly unhinged by what is, on the surface, a single death, Allie's. This inability to transition successfully undermines the power of his social critique, especially when Salinger himself provides a moment of mature potential, symbolized by that resolution at the carousel, which Holden initially resisted but eventually observes with a sort of distanced acceptance.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that the failure to assimilate is a structural flaw. The subversion of the Bildungsroman is the very argument Salinger is making about post-war American society. The narrative implies that successful assimilation into that phony adult world is inherently a moral or authentic failure. Holden's placement in a psychiatric facility is the psychological cost of his refusal to conform. His moral integrity remains intact, even if his mental health does not.
Even so, his profound grief feels disproportionate to the event. How can the narrative sustain that existential weight when it's rooted in one singular, albeit tragic, loss?
Because that singular loss is an echo of profound existential trauma that Salinger knew intimately. We have to consider the author's own psychological landscape here. Salinger carried the transformative trauma of World War II
having participated in D-Day and later aiding in the liberation of the concentration camp Kafring 4, a subcamp of Dachau. Salinger himself drew connections between that experience, the memory of the dead, and Holden's struggle to comprehend life going on without his brother. Ali's death functions as a focal point for a much larger collective loss of innocence, lending immense existential weight to Holden's desperate need for stasis and his paralyzing fear of change.
That certainly gives context to the authorial intent, which is a powerful consideration. However, from a reader's perspective, just analyzing the character's actions, much of what Holden does seems rooted in this irrational, almost neurotic fear. Take his obsession with the ducks in Central Park, a symbol of impermanence and displacement, or his primary signifier of otherness, the red hunting hat.
What about the hat?
Well, it's clearly protective coloring, right? It's a calculated, self-conscious piece of theatrical performance that he strategically removes whenever he actually desires a genuine human connection. He wears it as armor, takes it off to signal openness. This suggests that his otherness and his alienation are, at least partially, a contrived performance, which diminishes the integrity of his protest. If he can turn the alienation on and off like that, how deep can the critique really be?
That's a compelling argument about the performative nature of his symbols. But have you considered the flip side? His deep connection to these symbols, the hat, the ducks, the Museum of Natural History, is not hypocrisy, but a necessary map of his internal life. The museum offers him immense comfort, precisely because its exhibits represent absolute stasis against the terrifying flux of life and the inevitability of change. His name, Holden Caulfield, suggesting he must hold on to the call or the innocence of birth, underscores that his deepest, most authentic desire is preservation.
But if his deepest desire is stasis, doesn't that just reinforce the narcissistic claim? An inability to progress beyond the self?
Lipus agree that narcissism is a defining feature. While he struggles with self-centeredness, sure, his behavior often demonstrates profound empathy and generosity, which really contradicts the simplistic narcissist label. Think about his interaction with his roommate, Stradlater. He goes out of his way to avoid embarrassing him about an inexpensive suitcase, deliberately hiding his own expensive luggage. That's an act of deep kindness rooted in respect for another person's dignity. He also shows genuine, unsolicited generosity to the nuns he meets, spontaneously offering them $10.
Okay, but these are isolated acts of kindness, perhaps. They don't fully outweigh his deep cynicism and his consistent judgment of almost everyone else.
But they demonstrate the authentic moral core Salinger is highlighting, and most profoundly, consider his fierce, unselfish love for his sister Phoebe and his ultimate dream, to be the catcher in the rye, a savior figure protecting children from falling off the cliff of adulthood. This is a dream of overwhelming altruism, a desire to protect universal innocence, which utterly contradicts the idea that his alienation is rooted merely in self-indulgent misery. Ultimately, the enduring power of Holden's voice is that his extreme language and alienation were generated by profound existential trauma. His fierce discontent was a necessary, even inevitable, critique of a post-war society consumed with image and conformity. His difficult voice was and remains a potent instrument of social and spiritual protest that forces the reader to acknowledge the moral cost of assimilation.
And ultimately, I think the debate hinges on whether we accept Holden's judgment as legitimate social critique, an intentional Jeremiad, or as the highly subjective account of an unreliable narrator struggling with intense self-contradiction, narcissism, and unresolved trauma. The text is so complex precisely because it forces the reader into the position of the analyst, continuously measuring the power of the argument against the integrity of the voice delivering it.
And the novel's longevity lies exactly in that insoluble paradox. It prompts us to continuously measure the provocative argument of the text against the difficult psychological reality of its contradictory protagonist. The fact that, 70 years later, we are still debating whether he is a prophetic voice or merely a whiny kid just shows that Salinger crafted a masterpiece of intentional, powerful ambiguity.